This week on the Best of Flashpoints, we continue our reporting on the multiple impacts of Obama's war policy. We'll speak to an anti-war veteran on the 26th day of a hunger strike in front of the White House. We'll revisit with a Native American anti-war mom and hear about her son's struggle against a devastating case of PTSD. Also, Kathy Kelly speaks out against Barack Obama receiving the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo, and an update on the case of Kevin Cooper and the fight to end the death penalty. All this straight ahead on this week's Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine. As I said in the billboard, we continue our reporting on the multiple impacts of Obama's expanding war policy now as he takes the country deeper into Afghanistan. And joining us to talk about these prices that we are paying at home is Thomas E. Mahaney. He is a vet from Vietnam who's on a 26-day fast, I think, at this point. Is that correct, Thomas?
Today's 27.
27 day. Today's the 27th day. And how are you doing?
Well, I'm starting to get a little tired and a little frustrated.
Frustrated. Where are you now?
Well, I'm in a hotel room about 4 blocks from the White House.
All right, let me, if I could, Thomas, let me just read a little bit of the letter that you wrote to the president when you started your fast on November 11th, by the way, who that was my father's birthday. And obviously people know it as Veterans Day. He was a war hero who hated war, that's for sure. But this is what you write, Thomas, to the president. In May of 1970, I spent 29 days in Lafayette Square fasting for peace in Vietnam. I now feel that it is time to act once again. Accordingly, on November 11th, Veterans Day 2009, I have taken my last material sustenance other than water until specific action is taken by administration and our military to stem the tragic and ever-increasing rise in the incidence of post-traumatic stress disorder, which is rapidly approaching epidemic proportions among our fighting men and women. I served in Vietnam, and I also lost a brother-in-law to suicide caused by PTSD. He had 2 young sons. I have seen firsthand that what this can do to a family. In taking my action, I hope to elicit for you from the peace-loving people of this nation moral support sufficient to spiritually bolster you as you make your decision concerning our military presence in Afghanistan. Well, Thomas Mahaney, he made his decision. The decision was a major expansion. Your response as you go into this 27th day of fasting?
Well, the military got what they wanted, all right? And the military is, they've been dictating our morality here for a while now. And they show no signs of letting up. My position is really a nonpartisan issue. You know, whether you're for or against the war, I'm trying to fight for the rights of the common everyday soldier, especially those soldiers that were dragged in to the back door draft into the Army from the National Guard and the Ready Reserve. And once they got in there, they wouldn't let them back out due to this stop-loss policy under the presidential authority in the U.S. Code. And they've been using this authority to their advantage, all right, without paying strict attention to the not just the letter, but especially the intention of that code, right? It wasn't drafted. The spirit has been circumvented, the spirit of the code itself, and they've taken these unfortunate individuals who were in a position of they saw themselves as maybe fighting their way out of their economic and social position by joining the armed forces, and this would help them lift themselves out of that position. And unfortunately, every individual who signs up for the military is signing up to fight. Now, how much of that did they really understand when they sign up? It depends on the individual. It also depends on the individual signing up, the recruiter. How much is he telling them? All right? And what is he telling them? It's, you know, we've all dealt with used car salesmen. And, you know, when you talk to people on the Hill, a lot of the people on the Hill, a lot of the legislative military assistants are actually active duty members of the armed forces that are on a fellowship program for 1 year to be assigned in these offices of the congressmen and the senators.
Let me interrupt and explain to people that, in fact, today you were back at the Senate and Congress, Foreign Affairs, I guess, trying to get some support for your cause. And so you were confronting these military placements within Congress. So you're making the point that even when you're dealing with Congress, you're dealing with the military, right?
Exactly. The military has their own liaison inside of these offices. All right. So they have not just a lobbyist. They have an inside pole position. All right. And if you want to route some military issue to the senator, you're going to go through these military men. And it's a very neatly wrapped up, and it's very difficult to get anything through that iron curtain.
And so, did you have any luck today on Capitol Hill?
I would say today was nothing today. I have had decent conversations with people in the front offices, but they're like three or four steps down the pecking order, and to get to the top of the pecking order, you have to go through these military people, and it's very difficult, especially if that military person happens to be a Marine.
That's amazing. We're speaking with Thomas Mahaney. He is on the 27th day of a hunger strike. He's literally putting his life on the line to call about a pandemic. I guess we have to say that of PTSD. And he is trying to tell us what pushed you over the line to put your life.
The incident at Fort Hood. I mean, the Army is, their plan is to, and I've had this, I had a Marine tell me this. He goes, you might as well take, he said, you have to take Fort Hood off the table. He goes, that was a terrorist act, and when all the facts come out, you'll see that it was. So my answer to that was, that's what you have planned. Is that correct? And that's the military. I mean, they're going to twist it. And they're gonna come up with.
You mean they're saying terrorist attack? They're saying terrorist attack instead of a major breakdown of morale and an epidemic of troubled soldiers.
Exactly. No, it was a terrorist. It was a terrorist issue. Yeah, and that was a Marine talking to me directly. You know, telling me that when all the facts come out, I'll see that there was a terrorist attack, and that's their attitude, you know. It's Semper Fi, and we are superior beings, and you guys just relax, and we'll take care of you.
All right. Well, we're worried about you, Thomas Mahaney. I want to ask you to stand by. I want you to continue in the dialogue. We're going to bring in a military mom who's right in the middle of this, whose son is desperately ill, and also joining the discussion. It's a mom who we had on last week, but I really wanted to come back and give her a chance to expand and tell her story. I'm talking about Georgia Stilwell Bissonnette. She joins us from the Black Hills of South Dakota. She's Native American, and that community around the reservations and around, you remember that name, Wounded Knee, is suffering terribly. Welcome back to Flashpoints, Georgia.
Thanks for having me, and I'm really honored to be on here with Thomas, and if I had the means, I would be right next to him. Because I think that's what needs to happen. People need to start showing up and parking themselves right in front of that White House. People should be out in the streets and giving of themselves. If I had the means to get there, I would be there with Thomas right now.
Georgia, let me read a little bit of the piece that you wrote, you put together, that appeared not too long ago on, well, actually a couple of years ago on Truth Out, when your son came home. Let me just read a little bit of it. You write, Georgia, "My brothers and sisters in peace, I wish I could tell you that since my son has returned to civilian life, our family is whole and happy, but this is not the case. My 21-year-old son is homeless, unemployed, and on January 11th in the morning, early morning, he drove his car over an embankment. Anyone who has seen the car says he shouldn't have survived the crash. I remember the day I got the phone call. My son was back in the States. I fell to the floor sobbing, thanking the Creator that my son was alive. Little did I know at the time that all that returned was a physical shell. My son's spirit and soul must still be wandering the streets of Iraq." Tell us a little bit more about your son and about some of the struggle that you have gone through with him. It is terrifying. You were describing to me, Georgia, a tattoo that he has put on his chest, which is essentially a graveyard in Iraq with many dead Iraqi names on the tombstones. And then he's got a tree with a collage with his sort of the dead faces and those who he killed and his dog tag. Tell us about your son.
That was just done, I want to say recently, within the past year. He put that tattoo on himself as kind of, I don't know if it's a memorial, a memory, if it's his, what's inside him coming out, because it's hard for him to talk about what he did. To me, it's a ghastly tattoo. But it's there forever. It's like he's putting it out to the world. Look at what I did. I realized what I did. I killed innocent people. I mean, it's horrifying to see that on my son. But to me, it's almost positive that he's expressing himself and he's saying, I killed people. And I know it was wrong. I mean, we all raise our kids to be moral people, and then we send them off to war where the military brainwashes them, and they start, and they do things they never thought they did, would ever do. My son told me the first time he killed someone, it was absolutely mind-devastating to him, and then after that, he called it business as usual. And now he re-experiences the trauma. You know, he has a loss of interest in life in general. He feels detached from others. He definitely has, like, an increased arousal. I talked to him today. He cannot sleep without chemicals in his body. Before the military, my son had goals to be a police officer. He didn't abuse chemicals. He wasn't a drinker. Never got in trouble with the law. And now he's had the whole gamut.
Started working when he was 14 as a dishwasher. Totally committed. Graduated high school. You were saying that he was sort of the cream of the crop that the military looks for. And now he's been in trouble. He's got substance. Tell us a little bit about what happened after that illustrious beginning.
Well, when he came back from Iraq, one of his superior officers basically said, you know, just drink it away. Well, 2 weeks before redeployment, he was to be redeployed. He had only been back about 6 months. He was caught with some other soldiers drinking, smoking marijuana. They kind of made an example of him, and they court-martialed him and sent him to a naval brig in Florida for 7 months. Then they stripped him of, he was a specialist. They stripped him down to a private, ripped off all his medals and his stuff on his uniform, his badges, and gave him a general discharge under honorable conditions because he had been decorated in combat. And then just sent him on his way. And then since
then, you're lucky to get out of there with an honorable discharge.
It was a general discharge under honorable conditions.
Right.
Yeah.
But it wasn't dishonorable.
No.
It wasn't other than honorable.
Yeah. Right. But he feels like he can't even go to the VA and get any help, and all the college money he was promised was taken away. You know, they didn't offer him help. You know, I had called Fort Bragg and let them know that I was concerned for my son. I called the chaplain. They couldn't even find my son. And I said, no wonder we can't find Osama bin Laden. But right now, you know, when I talked to him today, he said, well, you can, I said, is there anything you want me to say on the radio? He said, you can tell the U.S. Army thanks. Thanks for ruining my life.
Yeah, yeah. And that, now that same Marine I was talking to before about, or talking about before, that told me that I had to take Fort Hood off the table. He also told me that the number of DTS cases are greatly exaggerated because most of them are just DUIs, and anybody that gets a DUI and anybody that gets in trouble for drugs, they blame it on PTSD. So you gotta subtract all those cases from the total of the incidents. And he doesn't see that it's the drugs and the alcohol come after the PTSD, not before.
Absolutely, and that is, we're seeing so much of that with the military families. I have a lot of contact with military families, and they're seeing the same things. And it's brushed under the carpet. The world really doesn't want to talk about it. And
no, they don't.
And being indigenous people, family is the most important thing to us. Family is everything. And now we're waiting for our soldiers to come home, our children to come home, and they come home, and they're completely different people. We never will get our children back the way we sent them. And he joined. He volunteered. But who knows what war is?
Nobody does. They can think they do, but you don't know until you get there.
Right. Who can explain to a 17-year-old what war is? You don't know until you get there.
Right. But now they told me today in one of my meetings, it was an ex-GI. This guy's he's a bureaucrat in the House Armed Services Committee itself. He's one of the aides to the committee. He said he piped up right from the beginning. He goes, look it, they signed on the line. They knew when they signed on the line they were going to battle. And that's it. And that was his answer. Because they signed, they knew what they were getting themselves into. There is no way they could understand. A 17-year-old kid, he grew up watching TV. There is no way that he knows what a real battle is.
Georgia,
right?
I'm sorry.
It's not like it is on television. It smells, you know, it stinks. And it's in living color, not at the end of a cathode ray tube. It's right in front of
you. Well, you know, Georgia, you were saying your son was really, if I remember correctly, you said that he actually enlisted after 9/11 and he wanted to
Yes, he enlisted after 9/11, a couple days after. He went in through the delayed entry program. He felt that our country was in jeopardy as indigenous people. We feel very strongly connected to our land and to our people and the need to protect our people. And so that is what he stepped up to do. But he was sent on a completely different mission. And if you look at our reservations, we are the poorest counties. You know, our unemployment is out of this world. But, you know, the Native population, we make up about 1%, but we make up 1.6% of the armed forces. You know, in our family alone, we have at least 20 relatives in the military right now.
You have 20 relatives. And you were saying, Georgia, that actually you, having been in this and resisted, that you noticed that you were working in a rehabilitation center and the recruiters actually came into the rehab center?
Yes, I was working for the tribe, a different tribe in Wisconsin, and the local recruiter came in to the treatment center to look for possible recruitments.
Sure, it's good. It's good pickings, like fishing in a fishbowl.
Our reservations are just cannon fodder. We are cannon fodder for the nation. We're easy pickings.
So are the people in downtown Detroit.
Right, and
I
only know that they go to the poorest counties and look for soldiers there.
They don't go to the colleges, do they?
No, they don't. And that was another thing. My son.
This is a high tech war. They want very bright people, but they don't go to colleges and recruit.
My son wanted to go to college. He knew we were poor, that I would not be able to afford to send my son to college. And that was one of his goals. Like I said, one of his goals was to be a law enforcement officer. He does not have any of those goals. And now he has a felony on his record.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I am deeply grateful to be speaking with both of you. Both of you are very special people, taking a very courageous stand to talk about a devastating situation that hundreds of thousands of GIs, soldiers, and their families takes it into the millions are facing now. I want to get a final word first from you, if I could. Thomas, you're really risking your life now on the 27th day of a hunger strike.
And it's all falling on deaf ears,
and
especially the media. The media doesn't. I had a film crew come down here from my hometown in Detroit. They interviewed me for an hour, and they took the film back with them. And the editor said this isn't worthy. They already had the film. They already had the interview, and they decided not to run the show because it's not worthy of airing. They'd rather put something about a womanizer or a party gate crasher or somebody going rogue. That's what makes the news.
And we thank you for your courage. That's the voice of anti-war activist from way back from the Vietnam War, Thomas C. Mahanian. Georgia Stilwell Bissonnette, I want to give you the final word. We're going to keep our dialogue going with the soldiers and with the folks such as yourselves who have taken these kind of courageous actions. We need to talk about what's happening at home and the multiple impacts of these kinds of expanded wars. Let me give you the final word, Georgia.
Well, I want to say that, you know, we're in two wars right now, but we're actually in three. There's a war here at home, a war to save our children and our wives and our husbands and all our relatives, to save them. And the blood right now is on Obama's hands. There's no excuses. anymore, and people need to step out in the street and care. We make up such a small population, military families. We need people's help. Our children are suffering, and they gave it all they could, and some gave their lives. And every family I come into contact with, whether they've lost a child or their child has just been over there, our lives are completely and forever changed, and we're devastated, and we're tired, and we're out there in the streets because we don't want this to happen to anyone else. And when I saw the president's address and I saw those faces in the crowd, I just started sobbing because I know what happens to the families, and no one is immune from it. There won't be one single soldier that'll come back and be like, oh, it was okay. It doesn't happen that way, and we need everyone's help.
All right. Well, I want to thank you, Thomas in Georgia. Thomas in front, a couple of blocks away from the White House on 27th day of a very dangerous fast, trying to call attention to the traumas that hundreds of thousands are facing. Georgia Stillwell Bissonnette talks to us from the Black Hills of South Dakota. This is the territory of Native Americans, the territory of Wounded Knee, and they are continuing, as you hear, to play a horrible price. We thank both of you for joining us. Please keep in touch.
Thanks so much.
Oh, I'm just a student, sir, and I only want to learn. But it's hard to read through the rising smoke from the books that you like to burn. So I'd like to make a promise, and I'd like to make a vow that when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now. Number, and you've taken off my name. To get around this campus, why, you almost need a plane. And you're supporting Chiang Kai-shek while I'm supporting Mao. So when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now. Oh, you'd like to be my father, you'd like to be my dad, and give me kisses when I'm good and spank me when I'm bad. But since I left my parents, I've forgotten how to bow. So when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now.
In today's Night Report, even as President Barack Obama accepts the Nobel Prize for Peace in the midst of his doubling of the number of troops over the number that George Bush sent into Afghanistan, there are signs that the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq will last for many years to come. Today, Defense Secretary Robert Gates said that he was surprised by Afghan-installed President Hamid Karzai's statement that it would be two more decades, 20 or 15 years before his country could afford the new larger security force that the Obama administration is demanding be trained and funded in the coming years. Robert Gates is currently visiting Afghanistan, meeting with Karzai and U.S. troops in the region. Also, General David Petraeus said that violence in Afghanistan and turmoil within the U.S.-installed regime were likely to increase during the coming escalation. He's in charge of the forces in Iraq and overseeing the troops in Afghanistan as well. He says that he expects increased fighting in the spring and in the summer. Traditionally, the combat goes down because of the freezing territory in the mountains that impede travel. He also said that President Karzai's expected moves to combat corruption would result in, quote, greater turmoil within the government as malign actors are identified and replaced. He continued, it will be important, therefore, to withhold judgment on the success or failure of the Obama strategy in Afghanistan until next December. Petraeus told the Senate committee that judgment should be withheld for another year or so before reassessing the Obama escalation. Similar words are coming from NATO today. They will step up fighting in Afghanistan next year. There's going to be 37,000 more troops joining the conflict, between 30 and 35,000 from the United States and a few more thousand from the various NATO nations. A spokesperson for NATO, General Eric Tremblay, said that the increase in tempo, quote, could lead to increased collateral damages, end quote. He said that he hoped that risk would be mitigated by the use of, quote, tactical directives. the United States is sending 30,000 to 40,000 more troops to the war. That would be after the 34,000 that President Obama sent there earlier this year. President Bush sent only 32,000 troops to Afghanistan. And so within the next year, there could be between 100,000 and 150,000 combined U.S. and NATO troops in that nation. And those are just some of the stories developed today. This is Robert Knight reporting live from New York for Flashpoints.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our discussion of Barack Obama receiving the Nobel Peace Prize today, and joining us to talk about that and the expanding wars is Kathy Kelly. Kathy Kelly is co-coordinator of the group Voices for Creative Nonviolence, and she is a signatory to a letter to the Norwegian Nobel Committee signed by dozens of peace groups. The letter states, quote, "We are distressed that President Obama, so close upon his receipt of this honor, has opted to escalate the U.S. war in Afghanistan," and it goes on. Kathy Kelly, welcome back to Flashpoints. Your initial response to Barack Obama getting this award at this time, right after announcing a major expansion of the war from West Point.
Well, Janice, my very initial response when I first heard of the award going to Barack Obama was that maybe General McChrystal in Afghanistan would be saying, oh, brother, how am I going to get the surge of troops that I've asked for if he's going to go over and pick up the Nobel Peace Prize? But as we realized, that didn't deter the administration from going ahead and seeking a surge in troops to Afghanistan. And I think, you know, it's an appropriate time, though, to recall very carefully the words of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. When he was a Nobel laureate, he made it very clear in his acceptance speech that you can't pursue nonviolence and press for retaliation. The two don't fit. And unfortunately, President Obama has seen fit to cast his, quote, necessary war against Afghanistan and now Pakistan as a fit, a just retaliation. But I think it's more like mafiosa tactics, actually, when you look at what, for instance, we're saying to Pakistan at this very time, it's cast in this do more language. Pakistan must do more to eliminate Taliban groups. And if they don't, then the United States, which is not at war with Pakistan, will come in with more intensified drone attacks in the Balochistan area, sure to cause tremendous destabilization. And this at a time when Pakistan is reeling from the military offensives, which have created millions of refugees and so much disturbance within the country and retaliatory attacks from jihadist groups.
Now, Barack Obama did in fact campaign on a peace platform. And many, many people had very high hopes. I have to admit I wasn't among them. But he certainly has demonstrated that he's inclined towards the military from the speech at West Point, keeping Robert Gates on, the Bush defense secretary. And when you listen to his, as you say, you listen to his speech today from the award, and he's talking about just war. What does he mean by that as you're going on? I mean, this is the kind of expansion that could lead us down a road of decades of war, and here he gets the peace award. I guess it's confusing for young people.
Well, I think that the Nobel Committee perhaps didn't intend it to be as Orwellian as it certainly seems or as paradoxical. They said specifically it was for his diplomatic work and building bridges between people internationally. But certainly we have to look at the reality that we're facing, that any president of the United States is the arms exporter in chief, and we export 68% of the world's armaments, even if we weren't escalating our troop strength in Afghanistan, even if we weren't now beginning to attack Pakistan so regularly with our drone attack planes, these unmanned aerial vehicles. You know, I think that President Obama greatly wants to have a chance to be a two-term president, and that's very costly. I can imagine that he would have a hard time being elected to a second term if he ends the wars both in Iraq and in Afghanistan. To my mind, however, I can't imagine a greater achievement. And if it cost him a second term in the presidency, nevertheless, this would be a great achievement to put an end to the war in Afghanistan. But now the ball is in our court. I think we have to work as hard as we possibly can, give every minute of every hour that we possibly can to build a movement that in 2011, in July, can say to President Barack Obama, you said the troops would begin to come home. We want them all to start coming home now.
And if people are concerned, what kind of action do you recommend?
Well, I think we certainly need to keep on creating the small group grassroots communities. And I've been myself so grateful to mingle with a lot of those communities cross-country. They're strong and they're determined. But we also have to try to build a large street presence. The world came closer than ever before to stopping a war before it started in 2003. This war now has gone on for 8 years. And it's my hope that we can begin to move toward greater mobilizations, but also go into the elected representatives' offices. I'm working very hard to focus on the White House between January 19th and February 2nd with the Peaceable Assembly campaign that Voices has launched. And we welcome anyone, although it would be a far trip for most of your listeners at Flashpoints, but we'd welcome people if they happen to be heading to D.C. to join us during that time. And we'll do 10 consecutive days of civil disobedience in Washington, D.C. But as soon as that stretches through, the president will have submitted by February 2nd the budget for 2011. And we want people to go into their elected representatives' offices and say, pull those purse strings tight. Shut the purse strings. Don't fund these wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan and ongoing troop presence in Iraq.
One more question I wanted to ask you. Barack Obama has turned to use Iraq as an example of an effective, successful war, withdrawing to the countryside, as the model for Afghanistan, Pakistan. What goes through your mind when you hear that?
I do think it's an obscenity, Dennis, to say to people in Iraq that we achieved a success in their country. We've devastated Iraqi society. What have they got? They don't have hospitals. They don't have schools. They don't have a middle class. They don't have electricity in many areas. They don't have much of a future for their children in terms of jobs and employment. 5 million people have left the country. Families have been bereaved. Millions have lost their lives in the combination of economic sanctions and the war. What have they got? They've got a surge. Are we to say that they're lucky? That the corruption is so high that we've basically been paying people not to attack the United States troops? And are we to say that's a successful template that we'll then impose on Afghanistan? Are they then the poorest country in the world to be delighted that we've come over to give them bereavement, destruction, bloodshed, and a quagmire of our troops being there as, a continuation of war, endless war? Who benefits? I think we have to look at the security contractors, Kellogg, Brown & Root, Blackwater, Dyncor, Triple Canopy, and of course the big weapon makers. These are the ones who are the beneficiaries of this war. But let's not act as though we're doing something kindly and humane for the poorest people in the world. Afghanistan was actually named by United Nations High Commission for Refugees as the worst country into which a child can be born. Excuse me, that was UNICEF that made that call. November 20th, the worst country in the world into which a child can be born.
Wow. Kathy Kelly, we appreciate all your good work, and people can learn a lot more about Voices for Creative Nonviolence and what your civil disobedience is all about. They can go to the website, right?
Right at www.vcnv.org. And also enduswars.org is the website for a demonstration happening December 12th. Representative Dennis Kucinich will be there, former Senator Mike Gravel, former Representative Cynthia McKinney. It's a good opportunity for people to gather and mobilize and start to build that visibility that represents the 61% of the U.S. public that doesn't want this war.
Kathy Kelly, thanks for being with us again on Flashpoints.
Thank you, Dennis. Flashpoints is the best.
Daughter of a soldier told the fallen priest it's a cold, cold place in the arms of a thief. Reaching out to touch the steering wheel, she said, leave me alone, but just don't leave me here, all right.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. It is time for an update on death row prisoner Kevin Cooper and to remember the life and times of Stanley Tukey Williams. There are two very special people in the studio with me, and we've been through some hard times together, but what a privilege it is to know the both of you, and I want to tell you who they are. Barbara Bechdel is the author and friend of Stanley Tukey Williams. You heard Stanley Tukey Williams, I think it was the last interview.
It was his last radio interview.
You've heard several interviews with Kevin Cooper, and joining us is a friend of Kevin Cooper, Crystal Bybee. She's an activist, and she visits with Kevin. And right now, we lost that battle to keep Stanley Tukey Williams alive in the flesh. We're going to talk about how we keep him alive in the spirit, but we're going to talk about keeping Kevin Cooper alive right now. And we did a recent update, Crystal, as you know, bad news. The Supreme Court would not take action despite all the evidence that show that he was not guilty of this crime. Would you remind people of the recent decision? What happened?
Sure. Thank you, Dennis. On November 30th, the Supreme Court upheld the Ninth Circuit Court's denial of Kevin Cooper's appeal. And while I am not shocked, I'm certainly disappointed, and Kevin is disappointed by the ruling because of the overwhelming evidence of Kevin's innocence and the constitutional issues, the ways in which the prosecution violated Kevin Cooper's rights. They're not allowed to destroy evidence, withhold evidence from the defense. These are all felonies. And, well, speaking of felonies, actually, a deputy who was the manager of the crime lab where some of this evidence was compromised actually was caught stealing heroin from an evidence locker. So there were felonies of multiple kinds happening during the frame-up of Kevin Cooper.
And so where is it now in terms of the decision? Are we on the fast track to the death house?
Well, we sort of are. And I say sort of because this was his last appeal, although people should know that when they say it's your last appeal, you can certainly keep trying to find new evidence, find new issues to appeal on. And this is where we were in 2003 before they tried to execute him in 2004. So it's certainly not the end of the
road. And there was new evidence that indicated that there could be a lot more new evidence in terms of Kevin Cooper's case, and I guess the attorneys in their press release were asking people to come forward.
Correct. They are hoping that additional people with information do come forward, because that would really make the difference right now for Kevin Cooper. And what happened after 2004, in a nutshell, is the case went back down to a lower court, and they managed to not give Kevin Cooper what he was supposed to have, which was a full and fair hearing. They did not do that. They wouldn't even let his attorney see some of the evidence that was supposed to be tested. When testing did find that evidence had been tampered with, they withdrew the results with no real explanation and really would not let his attorneys do anything that they needed to do to prove his innocence. So he appealed back up to the higher courts, and he came within a few votes of winning an appeal from the Ninth Circuit Court. And it was a very, very close vote. And five judges signed on to a 100-page document that said the state of California may be about to execute an innocent man. And that's where we are now.
That's where it is now. And why don't you just, people who have been listening to the show a long time have heard Kevin Cooper's voice on this broadcast. I actually have a painting that he sent us up in my office. We sit some 15 miles from death row at the prison, which overlooks one of the most beautiful views in the world. It is a contradiction. Talk about cruel and unusual punishment. It has many variations. But some people don't know, and some people are listening for the first time. So why don't you just say a little bit about why you have spent so much time, Crystal, going to the prison and trying to fight for his life?
Well, to me, Kevin's case, he is innocent. He's innocent on death row. And the facts of the case have always been very compelling, not just to me, but to many, many people. And what they have done to Kevin Cooper is, you know, originally the crime that he was convicted of in 1983, a family was murdered. And nothing about the case ever pointed to Kevin Cooper until they decided that it should. Being in the wrong place at the wrong time for Kevin Cooper meant that he was identified as a suspect, not originally. Originally, they thought there were three white men that had done the crime, which was what the survivor of the attack had, who was a young boy, who said that there were multiple people and that they were not Kevin Cooper and were not African-American. But once they discovered that Kevin had been in the wrong place at the wrong time, they really did everything in their power to ensure that they would have a conviction, which includes, and these are all things that are in this document written by the judges that I mentioned, which people should read. Even though it's written by judges, it reads like a novel because they go through all of the destruction of evidence, creation of evidence, ignoring piles of evidence pointing to other people. The judges wrote that the sheriff's department manipulated and planted evidence in order to convict Cooper. They discounted, disregarded, and discarded evidence pointing to other killers. So I really wouldn't even be able to go into all the specifics of the evidence, but really what they've done is they have spent the last 25 years in order to maintain the conviction of an innocent man, they've had to go back and continue to tamper with the evidence and tamper with it and make sure that he stays where he is.
And just to remind people, and there was also an extraordinary racist act taking place. Could you just...
Yes.
Racism comes into
there was... This. Racism played a very big part. In his conviction, there were essentially racist lynch mobs outside of his trial. There were, I actually have the pictures, there were people with signs, there were toy gorillas hung in effigy with nooses around their necks and signs with horrible racial slurs on them. And people really wanted to see Kevin Cooper hang for this crime, even though obviously all the evidence pointed to other people doing it. And people may not know this, that sometimes the courts say, well, you may be right about some of the things that the police or the prosecution did, but it wouldn't have made a difference. Even if the jury had known all of this, it wouldn't have made a difference. But that's not true. It would have. And the jurors at the time said if there had been one less piece of evidence, they probably would not have convicted Kevin Cooper. And when you look at all of the evidence that they really manipulated with and presented that wasn't true, I fully believe if they hadn't done all of that, they would never have convicted Kevin.
That's the voice of Crystal Bybee. She is an activist, and she's a good friend of Kevin Cooper. She visits Kevin Cooper on death row, and she's going to be at an upcoming event in which we're going to remember Stanley Tookie Williams. He was executed by the state, and it was a huge loss because what a contribution this man was busy making to society to save many lives. We have a friend, somebody who was a very close friend to Stanley Tookie Williams. That's Barbara Becknell. And there's going to be an event coming up, I guess, this Sunday,
December 13th,
from 3 to 6 p.m. at Merritt College, and Crystal's going to be there. You're going to be there. Angela Davis is going to be there. We're going to say more about this in a moment, but welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you so much.
Good to have you with us. Take a moment to remind people who Stanley Tookie Williams was and what happened.
Stanley Tookie Williams, Stanley sure. Tookie Williams was an extraordinary human being. I knew him the last 13 years of his life. He was the co-founder of the Crips. He wrote 10 books, anti-gang, anti-violence books for kids. He was nominated 5 times for the Nobel Peace Prize and 4 times for the Nobel Prize in Literature. He did extraordinary work from a 4-by-9-foot cell. And what we got from, in listening to Crystal talk about Kevin, and Kevin was one of his friends, it made me think of Stan. And the question is, what do you have to do to get justice in this country? I mean, what do you have to do? And
you have to be white and rich.
That's exactly correct. That is exactly correct.
Because it's a criminal injustice system, because there's a pattern of racism. And if you can't buy the lawyer, you don't get the justice.
That's exactly right. And just to give a quick, people assume that because Stan was the co-founder of the Crips that he therefore, by definition, was guilty of these crimes. And a lot of people even assume that they were street gang-related crimes. In fact, he claimed his innocence from the day he was arrested, and I was with him the last day of his life. I was there, and he was as innocent and proclaimed as strongly on that day. And in fact, as he did throughout the 20-something years that he was on death row. But, and just to give one example of the racism, in Stan's case, and again, it gets back to the Supreme Court being pretty arbitrary in terms of their own case-setting precedents, and that is Stan's DA, district attorney, who tried the case against him, had a pattern and practice of only selecting, he was a white guy, he only selected black or brown guys to prosecute for murder. And then he would talk at the end of the case. He would refer to them as animals. And in fact, he would eliminate all of the blacks off the jury. So Stan had no blacks on his jury. He was moved from downtown L.A. to a suburb in L.A. in Southern California called Torrance, where there were only 3 blacks in the entire jury pool of 100. And then those 3 were kicked off. And then at the end of the trial, in his closing statement, he looked at the white jury and said, when you look at Stan, consider that you are looking at a Bengal tiger in the San Diego Zoo. And that where he lived, meaning South Central LA with the black community, that was the equivalent, he said, to a jungle, wild jungle habitat. I mean, this is the kind of stuff, and the Supreme Court allowed that to pass. And this is the guy who had 2 of his cases reversed for doing this. But I want to also say one other thing about following up on where Kevin is now, and that is, under the circumstance that Stan was under, Kevin, by now, he'd have a date, an execution date. We would be scrambling now to maybe have, he'd probably have more than they gave Stan. They only gave Stan about 63 days, which was unheard of. But he would probably have 90 days. He would maybe 120 days. The reason he does not, now we go back to Stan again, is because Stan was tortured to death. I was in the death chamber. I saw it. And it took Stan 35 minutes to die. It's the worst thing I've ever experienced in my entire life. By lethal injection. So what has happened is that a federal judge, Judge Jeremy Fogel in San Jose, because stands, because we all mobilized and made Stan such a high-profile case, his high-profile torturing caught the attention of a federal judge in San Jose who did an investigation and came to the conclusion that, in fact, that the way San Quentin was running lethal injection procedures, it was tantamount to cruel and unusual punishment. So where we are now is no one has been executed in, what, about 3.5 years. And so on one level, it's a sad thing to say, but on one level, Stan's sacrifice of being tortured to death has held up executions for about 3.5 years or maybe a little more. And so we are still battling to keep the executions from starting up again. Therefore, the state cannot give Kevin an execution date right now, which they would have done. So we still have an opportunity to fight.
That's the voice of Barbara Becknell. Again, there's going to be an event coming up. For those of you living in the Bay Area, it's happening Sunday, December 13th. This is the upcoming Sunday. It's going to happen at Merritt College. That's at 12500 Campus Drive, Oakland, 12500 Campus Drive, Oakland. Here's the phone number if you want more information, 510-235-9780. Let me give you that again, 510-235-9780. And we just have about a minute left, and I'd like to split it. All right, I'll give it to Crystal. Barbara yields to Crystal.
Okay, thank you for those thoughts, Barbara. And I do think that what we need to do is use this time. We don't want to sit around and wait for the state to start executing people again. That we really, if we start building now the kind of movement to stop them, because it's never just been about Kevin Cooper or Stanley Tookie Williams. It's about everyone on death row. And savekevincooper.org. is the website where we have lots of information. You can read these, this legal document that I was speaking of, fact sheets, press releases, and of course, stay tuned for more actions because we really want to build the movement now to stop them from executing Kevin or anyone in California.
Well, we're going to see if we can hook up another interview with Kevin, because we certainly like to hear what he has to say at this point in this struggle, and we always do our best to be with the people on death row who we call prisoners, not inmates, because they are prisoners.
That's
of the
exactly
state,
right.
And they're about to be murdered, or they're trying to murder Kevin Cooper, and that's what this battle is about. This is this event Sunday includes Angela Davis, Barbara Becknell. It includes Crystal Bybee, the mom of Oscar Grant, and we don't have to say anything more. I thank both of you. We're out of time, but I do thank both of you for coming in and being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very
and
much.
I thank Dev for being at the board today and Nora for working so hard with the rest of the crew.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.